Good afternoon and welcome to Open Air, KLW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts. I'm your host, David LaTulipe. Today I'll be talking with two of the stars from Hamilton, actor Brendan Louis Armstrong, who plays both Hercules Mulligan and James Madison, and Simon Longknight, who plays the dual roles of the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson. Also stopping by, composer David Conte and violinist Anna Pressler, who is artistic director of the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble, to talk about their upcoming concerts featuring David's clarinet sonata along with three world premieres. Concerts are this weekend. I'll also talk to director Melissa Carey about the production of the musical Bullets Over Broadway at the Foothill Music Theater. Bullets is written by Woody Allen, based on the black comedy crime film he directed back in 1994. Plus, Open Air's regular contributor and critic at large, Peter Robinson, talks with the mellifluous Noah Griffin about an upcoming concert organized by the Cole Porter Society celebrating the music of Nat King Cole and Ella Fitzgerald. Also a conversation with local author Sylvia Varang about her book, Two Breaths, One Step, Sylvia's Journey Across the Himalayas. Stay with us. Very pleased to start off this week's show with a couple of friends of Open Air, regular contributors to our airwaves, and now associated with the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble, David Conte, very much so. Anna Pressler is a violinist and longtime member of the Left Coast, and currently its artistic director, also a member of the New Century Chamber Orchestra, has performed as a soloist with the ensemble as well. With degrees from Yale and the San Francisco Conservatory of Music, as well as the North Carolina School of the Arts, she is well equipped to be at the helm of the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble. She formed the Onyx Quartet with Phyllis Cameron, Kurt Rohde, and Leighton Fong back in 1995, the ensemble which merged with the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble and continues to perform and record. Anna, welcome back to our airways.
Thank you. Good afternoon.
Composer David Conte seems to be everywhere these days, and not just with area ensembles, including the Chorus Capella SF, led by Ragnar Bolden, who was my guest last week. David is currently composer in residence with that ensemble, which offered the world premiere of his Madrigals for the Seasons last week. David was one of the last students of the legendary teacher Nadia Boulanger and also studied with Aaron Copland. He's chair of the composition department and professor of composition at SF Conservatory of Music and on the faculty of the European American Music Alliance, Nadia Boulanger Institute en Paris. His opi now include over 100 published works, including six operas, a musical, works for chorus, solo voice, orchestra, chamber music, etc., etc. David, a pleasure to welcome you back to our way.
Thank you,
well.
David. Good afternoon.
And let me first ask, how did the premiere go last week with Capella SF?
Wonderful. I was pleased that the Classical Voice Review actually quoted me when I gave some opening remarks and said, this is the Rolls Royce of choruses, because it certainly is. And Roger and I have had a long association working together at the Conservatory with the San Francisco Symphony Chorus and with Capella SF. It was great.
And two performances, one of which is at Mission Dolores. That must be an interesting space to hear your works.
Yes, it's kind of their home where they like to perform the most, and it's a very flattering acoustic for them.
Anna Pressler, this is being billed as Bay Area Spotlight Kurt's Farewell Tour, Part 2. Kurt was Sarah Cahill's guest last week on Revolutions Per Minute for an extended segment. And this concert includes three world premieres in addition to David's Sonata for Clarinet and Piano. First of all, why the title and how did this program come together?
Kurt upset all of us when he started talking about his farewell tour, and then he explained that it has 7 or maybe 12 parts. And so then we weren't as concerned. We think it's going to be more like when Cher retires. Maybe it'll take a while. But he wanted to, as his final project, promote the work of many composers that he's interested in, and I think he realized it'll take him a very long time to do it. So this program features these beautiful amber-quality instruments, the clarinet and the viola. So we wanted to have David Conte's sonata, and then these beautiful viola works. Rebecca Clark's sonata is the old work on the program, because Left Coast always brings together new and old music. And then we have three premieres by Tina Talon, Peter Van Zandt Lane and Eleni Lilios, and they're all for viola and electronics, some with live electronics and some with fixed media. So the sounds are fantastic. It's a really wonderful palette of sonic delights, I think.
And is this a good place to insert the plug for the Kurt Rohde Emerging Composer Fund? Is that where some of these composers came out of?
Yes. Kurt has been phenomenal, always behind the scenes, promoting the work of emerging composers. And he often funds our commissions for new works, including these ones.
Mm-hmm. And this program is being repeated in San Francisco on Monday. It's Sunday, March 3rd at 7:30 p.m. at Berkeley Hillside Club. That's a venue you guys have been using for some time, isn't it?
Yeah, it's a really wonderful old historical building and lots of wood, and it's a nice long sort of shoebox shape, the way we like a venue to be, and flexible. So it's wonderful playing up there. Pretty near Chez Panisse if people want to go out to dinner first.
Oh, there you go. And tell us a little bit more about the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble and your founding of it and how it's thrived for so many years.
I think we're in our 26th season. It's 14 musicians, and many of the musicians have been playing together for almost 30 years. We're very interested in the intersection of new music and other things. We find that playing old music and new music side by side has each kind illuminate the other, brings a kind of a freshness to the old music and dedication to the new music. And we're also interested in the intersection of new music with other disciplines all across the humanities and occasionally even science. So we're doing this later in the year, for instance, new chamber operas about Artemisia Gentileschi, the Italian Baroque composer, a new opera by Laura Schwendinger, and also a new one by Chris Stark about the Depression-era photographer Dorothea Lange.
Wow, fantastic. We'll have to have you back to talk about that. That's fantastic. David, your association with the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble, how did that start?
Well, I'm honored and privileged and excited to have my first work done by this wonderful collective, which, of course, I've attended their concerts, known about their work for many years, and have known Kurt for a very long time as well. I was commissioned to write a clarinet sonata for Frank Cohen, who some of your listeners may know is longtime principal clarinetist of the Cleveland Orchestra. And Cleveland is my hometown. So Frank premiered this piece, and he connected me to Jerry Simas, who I didn't really know, actually, who's now teaching at the conservatory and, of course, is a member of the San Francisco Symphony. So Jerry had been Frank's student at the Cleveland Institute of Music. And I, in fact, was in touch with Frank recently about Jerry playing the piece, and he was so excited that that was happening. So Jerry, as Frank's student, is playing. This is now the third performance of the sonata for clarinet and piano.
And the pianist for these concerts will be?
Is Eric Zivian, who's superb.
Sure.
It's my first time working with him, and I've so enjoyed it. I think he's a really kind of extraordinary pianist and artist. And Jerry, too.
Mm-hmm. Eric, I've had on a number of occasions to talk about Left Coast projects, so it's great to have him performing as well. David, talk to us a little bit about your history and your development as a composer, studying with the great Nadia Boulanger and then for a time Aaron Copland.
Yeah, it's true that so I was born in 1955, and luckily in 1975 I came in contact with Nadia Boulanger. She's born in 1887. She was 87 years old. I studied with her for the last really 3 years of her life, so I'm one of her last students. Then when I came back to the United States, did my graduate work at Cornell, I wrote a thesis about Aaron Copland, and my thesis advisor was a very wonderful musicologist named William Austin, who had written the Grove Dictionary article on Copland, and he said, let's send this to Copland, who liked it and invited me to visit him. And then I spent the summer of 1982 living at his home. Actually, I didn't study composition with him, but I was doing a study of his manuscript sketches for Inscape, his last orchestral composition. And I wrote my doctoral thesis on that. And so I lived at his house for several months and really got to know him. And
certainly
it was
his music, absorbing that music.
Yeah, it was surreal to be living in the home of one of my heroes, certainly.
Mm-hmm. We do need to do a little cross-pollinization here for some cross-plugging. Your Copland portrait that you wrote is for orchestra is being performed by the Bay Area Rainbow Symphony on the 16th of March.
Yes, I'm excited about that, too. I love Dawn's work. I think Dawn Harms has brought that orchestra to a very high level. She had long wanted to do this piece, and this happened to be the right time to program it.
Mm-hmm. I'll be piccolo on that, so be listening for that.
Oh, wonderful!
And I want to tease this as well. It's in the new the Taube Center, which is going to sell out fairly fast. So get your tickets soon, bars-sf.org. But now back to our main topic of the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble, which I'm sure may be on the verge of selling out as well. We encourage you to go to leftcoastchamberensemble.org to secure your tickets. On this Sunday at 7:30 at the Berkeley Hillside Club, and Monday will be at the San Francisco Conservatory's Recital Hall on Oak Street. Are the farewell tours 3 through 12 also in the making?
Yes. Kurt's working so hard right now. I'm hoping maybe he'll take 1 year off and rest, but I don't know. I don't know what he's going to do next.
But let's talk about the upcoming concerts at a future date. And David, we're going to go out with some of your music for the clarinet, for the sonata for clarinet and piano. Tell us a little bit about its origins and what we're going to be hearing.
Well, one thing that I think is wonderful is that the form of sonata is ever alive. It's still very alive. Lots of composers still find new and fresh things to say with a form that evolved, of course, in the classical period and has been very durable. My sonata is in three movements. It's about 18 minutes long, and the first movement I think you have a recording of is really in very straightforward sonata form. I think the piece is quite dramatic. It has a lot of contrasting music in it. This performance is with Jose Granero, who's the principal clarinetist of the San Francisco Opera Orchestra, and John Churchwell, head of music staff there. They played it last year. Mm-hmm. And I guess I could say that I'm known more for writing vocal music, but writing all this vocal music helps you write instrumental music in terms of finding the impulse of the breath that's behind music and the
lyric line
impulse.
Of course, sure. Here's some of David's clarinet sonata, which you can hear this weekend as part of Bay Area Spotlight, Kurt's Farewell Tour Part 2, that being Kurt Rohde, long associated and one of the founders of the Left Coast Chamber Ensemble. David Conte and Anna Pressler, thanks so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Just a touch of David Conte's Sonata for Piano and Clarinet. That was Jose Granero, San Francisco Opera's principal clarinetist, along with John Churchwell. You can hear that this weekend, Left Coast Chamber Ensemble's concerts. And among the performers will be clarinetist soloist Frank Cohen, who was the former principal clarinetist of the Cleveland Orchestra. Also on that work, three world premieres, one by Tina Talon, one by Eleni Lilios, and Peter Van Zant Lane's Decalomanie number 2 for viola and electronics, featuring the more amber sounds of the ensemble. Kurt Rohde on viola, and again, clarinetist for that, Frank Cohen. Open Air here on Local Public Radio. Noah Griffin and concerts with the under the auspices of the Cole Porter Society just ahead. And now, as they say, something completely different.
Two Virginians and an immigrant walk into a room.
Diametrically opposed foes.
They emerge with a compromise, having opened doors that were
previously closed. Bros.
The immigrant emerges with unprecedented financial power, a system he can shape however he wants. The Virginians emerge with the nation's capital. And here's the pièce de résistance. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one really knows how the game is played, the art of the trade, how the sausage gets made. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happens.
Thomas claims
Alexander was on Washington's doorstep one day in distress and disarray.
Thomas claims
Alexander said,
I've nowhere else to turn,
and basically begged me to join the fray.
Thomas claims
I approached Madison and said, I know you hate him, but let's hear what he has to say.
Thomas claims
well, I arranged the meeting, I arranged the menu, the venue, the seating.
But no one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one else was in the room where it happened, the room where it happened, the room where it happened. No one really knows how the parties get to yes, the pieces that are sacrificed in every game of chess. We just assume that it happens, but no one else is in the room where it happened.
The room where it happens was that very private gathering where and when Alexander Hamilton, Thomas Jefferson, and James Madison created the Compromise of 1790 over a private dinner, exchanging Alexander Hamilton's new financial plan to transform the treasury for placing the country's permanent capital on the Potomac River. Well, unless you've been living under a rock, let me get you up to speed on Hamilton the musical. It's the story of America's founding father, Alexander Hamilton, an immigrant from the West Indies who became George Washington's right-hand man during the Revolutionary War and was the new nation's first Treasury Secretary. With book, music, and lyrics by Lin-Manuel Miranda, it blends hip-hop, jazz, blues, rap, R&B, and classic Broadway, and is the story of America then, as told by America Now. With deliberately blind color casting and causing at times a confusing but new spin on America's founding fathers, it's based on Ron Chernow's biography. The original and off-Broadway production in 2015 garnered too many awards to list, and its subsequent move to Broadway swept the 2015 Tonys, holding the record for most Tony Award nominations with 16 nominations. But with a mere 11 wins, it failed to beat the record held by the producers, which got 12 wins. Nonetheless, you'll have ample opportunity to catch the show here in San Francisco as the touring production is in town through the beginning of September. And to further enlighten us, we've got two of the men who were actually in the room where it happens. Simon Longknight plays the dual roles of the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson in the musical Phenom. He's an Oregon native, and Simon cultivated his musical talents at the University of Michigan, and his credits include another musical set in the same historical period of American history, 1776. Hamilton marks his Broadway and touring debut. He's also played the role in Puerto Rico recently before moving with the cast to San Francisco. Welcome, Simon.
Hi, it's good to be here.
Yeah, thanks for taking the time.
No problem.
Brandon Louis Armstrong plays both Hercules Mulligan and James Madison. He's part of the quartet of Rebels, along with Hamilton, Lafayette, and John Lawrence, who is quite the ladies' man in the first act. And as James Madison is also, as I mentioned, in The Room Where It Happens. Brandon's other credits include shows like Ragtime, Shrek, Beauty and the Beast, but nothing that quite compares to this size and scope, I imagine. And yes, the name isn't random. He is indeed a relative of the great Louis Armstrong. Welcome to you, Brandon.
What's up, man?
Hey, glad to have you again for taking the time out of this production. You guys are in a marathon right now. Just here in San Francisco, the show's running until September. How do you prepare yourself for something like that?
September at least.
Yeah. I mean, who knows? We'll see how it goes. Simon, why don't you start?
Oh, goodness. Okay. There's no real way to prepare for it. It's exhausting, exhilarating, amazing. I'm truly living my absolute dream. my dream role, my absolute dream role has been, since the show came out, Thomas Jefferson and Lafayette. So it's crazy that my first job out of school is playing Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson.
Oh, wow.
I'm feeling very blessed. And there's no way I could have prepared for how incredible being inside the pieces and how absolutely difficult it is. It's a beast.
It moves, too. It's not just like, you know, as much as I love 1776, that's kind of a stand in front of the room and sing kind of musical.
Yeah, I played Richard Henry Lee in
Oh,
that.
Great. And what a role. That's
yeah,
a good role.
It was a lot of fun. And I was in the first 20 minutes of the show, and then that was it. And then I didn't come in until the signing of the Declaration. So this show, I'm in it a little bit more in Hamilton.
I should say.
And it's hard.
just the rapidity of the words that you've got to enunciate so clearly for the audience, and kudos to the sound team, because you know, I was in the audience and you could really understand everything that's going on, but there's a lot going on.
Yeah, the sound team, everyone behind the scenes is that's real way the show happens every night,
and that's how you get through it. I'd say, like, for me, it's a day by day type thing. You know, you sort of check in with yourself every single day, because it is, like you said, a marathon, but really we have such an amazing team surrounding us, from the people who are on stage, the cast that's on stage, to the fellow cast members who are off stage. You just feel really supported. I think that's the only way to get through a show of this size. When you're exhausted and you're tired and it's a two-show day, being able to look over at the cast, you know, at your fellow castmate and clock in and check in and just be like, you know,
you gotta be 150% every time.
You really feel like you are in some way, you know, taking on this battle, you know, especially Act One. We talk about it all the time, where we sort of start at the top of the Revolutionary War and sort of move through it at a lightning speed, but it really does feel like, you know, being on the field with fellow soldiers, you know, and that helps you get through it.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, I would have to say that the community, as Brandon was saying, that's what gets you through it, and the work itself, like the material, getting to perform that every night and every afternoon. The material itself is exhilarating. It's Lynn and the entire team created something that's truly incredible.
Well, it's hard to believe that Lynn did the music, the lyrics, the book, the whole nine yards on this thing.
Yeah. And he had a great team behind him, just like supporting and fostering his creation.
Have either of you guys had a chance to meet the man who made it all happen?
Yeah, we got to perform with him in Puerto Rico.
Oh, fantastic. So, you were both in there.
Yeah. So
that must have been a trip.
It was incredible. It was incredible, and an experience that, you know, I will forever hold dear to me for the rest of my life. Mm-hmm. Just getting the call that's what you're going to get to do. Not only are you going to get to do Hamilton, but you're going to get to do it in Puerto Rico, and you're going to get to do it playing opposite Lin-Manuel.
It's crazy.
Yeah. And you learn so much more about the material. We're spoiled in that way. We got to have like a front row seat to how it happened, how it came about, and any sort of questions that you have sort of stepping into these roles, getting to have Lynn right there to be like, you know.
So like, Lynn, why do I say this? Actually, it's a reference to this and this and this.
Yeah.
And it's like, okay.
Well, he was a man obsessed with Ron Chernow's biography. That's the whole basis of the work is Ron Chernow. It's kind of a one-trick pony in that regard, in that there's been some criticism that was the sole source that he used for creating the musical, because there's historical inaccuracies that are inevitable when a musical work's created. I'm curious if either of you, beyond the Chernow biography, have become more inspired to learn more about that particular time of American history.
Oh, absolutely.
Absolutely, yeah. And I think what has been so fascinating to me, because I wasn't really, before doing the show, I wasn't really a huge American history buff. But learning how history back then in so many ways mirrors what's going on today, and you sort of watch the trajectory of this country and you see how we still are figuring so much out, mm-hmm. you know?
Mm. We're still so new.
Still so new, and it just, it puts so many things into perspective, you know? These sort of very three-dimensional people trying the best that they can, you know, to create something, and failing and succeeding and failing and succeeding, and it just sort of like this constant loop, like it's not finished, and being a 90s kid, you sort of, I feel like, I grew up and thought, I don't know, I thought America had been around since the dawn of time. Like, it never even dawned on me.
It always seemed like a done thing.
Yeah.
Now tell me, who was president when you were growing up?
When I was growing up, Bill Clinton, then Bush, and then Obama. So
thank you for not mentioning the next. Because it does seem like we're going, it must be frustrating too. I mean, it seems like we're, you know, it's that one step forward and now we're two steps back.
But that's it's like what we're talking about on stage and researching this time period. It was so much of that push-pull. Mm-hmm. These people with these brilliant minds who had a million different ideas of how this country should be governed, how, you know, what would be right for people. And I think really you sort of get an understanding that governance is incredibly difficult, mm-hmm. because no one person is going to have the perfect solution for millions of people. And so how does one or even a small group of people find a way to find compromise amongst a nation of millions? It's incredibly difficult and daunting.
I think we'll have to wait for Trump the Musical to figure that one out.
I think one thing that's very interesting about the first act and second act for us as performers is the first act, we are all fighting for a common goal, and that is to win the revolution. Mm-hmm. And we all... all of our energy is all being channeled in one direction towards that, other than the king, but we're not in scenes with him. And then second act, we come in and we now have won, but it's like, where do we take the country? Like, what do we make of this thing that we now have created? And that's where all the opinions start coming out, and that's where Thomas Jefferson and Alexander Hamilton, they start colliding. Because they all were fighting for one thing, which was to rise up and to have their own country. And now suddenly it's like, wait, how do we actually determine the fate of this thing?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And hence the compromise of 1780, among many other compromises that happened in the creation of this country.
Yeah.
Mm. That's Simon Longknight. He plays the dual roles of the Marquis de Lafayette and Thomas Jefferson in the musical Phenomena. Brandon Lewis Armstrong is also here, Hercules Mulligan and James Madison. Hercules Mulligan, not someone on everyone's tip of the tongue, Brandon. Tell us a little bit about Mr. Mulligan.
Oh, wow. Oh, my gosh. Mulligan, a tailor's apprentice. And his role in the Revolutionary War is a bit skewed because he isn't one of the most recognizable figures. But he was a spy, and he took down information, and he played a pivotal role in providing that information and aiding the Sons of Liberty. But it's interesting taking on a character like Mulligan because there wasn't a lot of material just specifically on him, you sort of get to create in a way that allows you to paint in a lot broader strokes than, like, Madison, where there's so much specific about James Madison and there's so much that's well-documented about James Madison. I think for me...
Well, if James Madison had Dolly Madison in the cakes, does Mulligan have Mulligan stew from his wife or something?
We'll go with that, yes.
But maybe we can look into the research. Maybe Ron Chernow has the answer to that.
Mulligan stew, yes.
Well, you move all over that stage. It's pretty amazing to watch you work.
Thank you so much, man.
The challenges must be myriad in terms of just manipulating a set like that.
Yeah, you know, we had the privilege during rehearsal to rehearse on the turntable that's on stage. And so we got used to that fairly quickly. But I think the hardest...
fairly quickly.
I'd say within a couple weeks, we were like, we got the handle of that. I think once you add, you know, the stairs and just how intricate the set
is. So many stairs.
So many stairs to climb. I don't think there is a way to mark through doing Hamilton. You either are full out or you're not.
Which brings me to the fact that you guys must have understudies for a run this long. You've got to. Mm-hmm. I mean, you could easily trip and break an ankle or something. So are people just like on stage or off in the wings examining your every move, or how does that work?
We have some amazing offstage understudies and swings, and they have an incredibly difficult job.
Yeah,
because a lot of them cover 3-4 parts, so that means they have to know all the music, all the blocking, and they have to bring life into each of those characters, and they are absolutely incredible.
True heroes of our show. Mm-hmm. are off stage and on stage covers and, mm-hmm. and swings.
They're the only thing that keeps it running.
Seriously. Mm-hmm. When you come see the show, I think there's a level of expectation, especially for all of the buzz that it's garnered and people who have listened to the record. When you come see the show, you really get to experience this thing, this juggernaut. It really just is a huge undertaking, and there is no way to do it without those people, you know. Mm-hmm.
Brandon, we just touched on the introduction of your very famous middle and last name. Tell us about your relations, not just someone, a family member who was a fan.
I'm named after my grandfather, who was Louis Henry Armstrong, but he was the nephew to the great Satchmo, Louis Armstrong. So I grew up in a household full of music and jazz. My grandfather's personal favorite musician was Cannonball Adderley, not Louis Armstrong, his uncle. Mm-hmm. It's crazy because you don't really think about it. I didn't think about it much. And when I started performing and using my whole name, everybody kept mentioning the Louis Armstrong of it all. And it wasn't a huge thing in our immediate household. I knew my grandfather came from a world of music, and I knew his connection to it was deep, and it was why I, you know, got into music. One of my favorite things to do as a kid, when he would pick me up from school, was to ride around in the car with him and listen to old jazz recordings. I wish I could have met the man.
Mm-hmm. Well, congratulations for now, both of you being in the room where it happens, so to speak. Brandon Louis Armstrong and Simon Longnight, have a wonderful run. We'll see you maybe again if I can afford another ticket. I should mention on that front that there is the Ham for Ham lottery.
Yes,
$10 tickets. Now, why is it a $10 ticket? Well, look at your picture of who's on the $10 bill. If you go to shnsf.com, you can find out about real life tickets or these $10 lottery tickets. Enter the lottery. You can enter day after day until you hit it right. And now, ladies and gentlemen, the King of England.
You say the price of my love is not a price that you're willing to pay. You cry in your tea, which you hurl in the sea when you see me go by. Why so sad? Remember we made an arrangement when you went away. Now you're making me mad. Remember, despite our estrangement, I'm your man. You'll be back soon, you'll see. You remember you belong to me. You'll be back, time will tell. You remember that I served you well. Oceans rise, empires fall. We have seen each other through it all. And when push comes to shove,
I will send a fully armed battalion to remind you of my love. Da 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 da. Subject, my sweet submissive subject, my loyal royal subject, forever and ever and ever and ever and ever, you'll be back like before. I will fight the fight and win the war. For your love, for your praise, and I'll love you till my dying days. When you're gone, I'll go mad, so don't throw away this thing we had. Cause when push comes to shove, I will kill your friends and family to remind you of my love.
Da 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 da. Indeed, you'll be back. That was Jonathan Groff from the original Broadway cast recording of Hamilton here in San Francisco for an extended run through the early September, maybe beyond. Get a lottery ticket. You may get a ham for ham for a $10 bill, a ticket to Hamilton. SHNSF.com for more information. Such a pleasure to have the guys on from Hamilton, the musical. Amazing music by Lin-Manuel Miranda, as you just heard, but a taste. Well, on a different front and taking us back several decades from present, Bullets Over Broadway, the musical, the Tony Award-nominated musical based on Woody Allen and Douglas McGrath's screenplay for the hit film Bullets Over Broadway, is a love letter to the golden age of Broadway and brings the classic musical comedy back literally with a bang, with songs that made the 1920s roar, like Let's Misbehave, Tain't Nobody's Business If I Do, and Up a Lazy River. The comedy features a young playwright, finally, who gets his play produced on Broadway, but discovers there's a catch. The mobster, putting up the funds, wants his ditzy, talent-free girlfriend to be the star. The multi-award-winning Foothill Music Theater presents the musical in Los Altos Hills through March 17th in Los Altos, and Melissa Carey directs, here to talk about the production. Melissa has directed Foothill Music Theater productions of Spring Awakening, Little Shop of Horrors, South Pacific, Sunday in the Park with George, Funny Thing Happened on the Way to the Forum, She Loves Me, Sideshow, Shrek the Musical, among others, and most recently, The Sound of Music. She's also an award-winning actress and has performed leading roles with many Bay Area theater companies, and was in the cast of the 25th anniversary Broadway National Tour of Evita under the direction of Hal Prince. In addition to teaching at Foothill College, she is on the faculty of the MFA program at ACT and the San Francisco Conservatory of Music. Welcome, Melissa.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Happy to have you. Let's talk about your first, the first time you saw or heard about Bullets Over Broadway. Was it the film?
It was the film, and it's one of my favorites. It's funny. It's not a spoiler alert, but I find myself at points in the day saying to people, don't speak. You know,
forgot about that line.
Don't speak.
don't speak.
So it was just witty, 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 and it's a fun period piece. And, you know, when they turned into a musical, it had had this sort of a strange process, as often musicals do. Woody Allen was resistant to, you know, developing it into a musical. Starting about 2000, they tried with standard composers like Marvin Hamlisch and Craig Carnelia, but the quality of that music just wasn't landing with the style of the piece. So it got tabled until somebody had a great idea that just used the classics from the era.
Right. It's different in that regard,
yeah,
in that it uses some of these great tunes rather than having its own original book.
Right,
or own music, at least. So tell us about your cast.
Oh, well, when you're doing a zany comedy, the first thing you need in your singer-actors is that they have to be funny. So our people are funny, and it really is a farce. So it gets going pretty quickly, you know, door slamming, gangsters running in plays, you know, dancing girls, the usual comedy mayhem.
And what do we see on the stage? Something very classic in that era of Broadway? And
right. It moves around. So much of the proceedings take place in Nick's club. He's the gangster with the money and the girlfriend. So we've got our we call them the Attagirls. So there's a lot of scenes that take place there. But then we move to various theaters as the play goes into development. And so we go through this somewhat comical rehearsal process of them trying to put this play up because, of course, again, not a spoiler alert, our playwright, not such a good playwright. His helper turns out to be one of the gangsters, who turns out to be a very good writer. Things develop and you know, not the least of which is one of the actors has a dog, Mr. Woofles. So we have an adorable little six-month-old puppy in the play who's in a couple of featured scenes.
Scene stealer, I'm sure.
Yes, indeed.
And the show runs through March 17th, mm-hmm. Thursdays at 7:30, Fridays and Saturdays at 8, Sundays at 2. Information at Foothill Theater, am I correct? foothill.edu/theater. Melissa, what's coming up after Bullets?
We're actually really excited to have gotten for our big summer show, we got the new version of Cinderella. So the 2013 Broadway version, which is a redux of the original. The new book is by Douglas Carter Bean, pretty terrific playwright. So it's got a lot of girl power in it, some social justice stuff in and around that classic fairy tale.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll look forward to maybe having you on again or some featured characters from that. Bullets Over Broadway is at the Lohman Theater in Los Altos Hills through March 17th. Information at foothill.edu/theater, and that's theater with an R-E. Mm. Melissa, I will have you back soon to talk about more
Great.
About this. Cheers. Literal Bullets Over Broadway for Bullets Over Broadway by Woody Allen, being staged by Foothill Theater, foothill.edu/theater for more information. Peter Robinson up next with a couple of segments, one with the mellifluous Noah Griffin and a conversation with an author as well, which you'll hear about shortly.
Mona Lisa, men have named you. You're so like the lady with the mystic smile. Is it only 'cause you're lonely they have blamed you for that Mona Lisa strangeness in your smile? Do you smile to tempt a lover, Mona Lisa? Or is this your way to hide a broken heart?
Many tears have been brought to your doorstep. They just lie there. And they die there. Are you warm? Are you real, Mona Lisa? Or just a cold and lonely, lovely work of art?
And that is the mellifluous voice of Noah Griffin putting an extra touch to Nat King Cole. And that's how Mona Lisa goes. So, Noah, welcome to KLW.
It's good to be back. Thank you so much.
And I should add that Noah is the president of the Cole Porter Society. We are talking about a different Cole today.
Yes, we are.
And last time we were talking about Cole Porter. Now, you're doing a performance at the Golden Gate on Sunday.
The Golden Gate Yacht Club, it's open to the public. It's right there on the marina, right down from the St. Francis Yacht Club. It'll be Sunday afternoon at 4 p.m., right around sunset. And we're going to be doing it in tribute to Nat King Cole's 100th birthday, which would have been March 17th. 1919. He came out of Alabama, went through Chicago. His last concert, in fact, was at the Circle Star Theater in San Francisco. And oddly enough, before that, he wanted to be booked at the Masonic Auditorium, but they turned him down because they thought he would attract the wrong crowd.
Oh, no, there you go. Well, you'll get the right crowd, and that'll be at the Golden Gate Yacht Club on Sunday. Now, I know you and I did see the movie The Green Book.
Yes.
And there was a reference to Nat King Cole having problems in a nightclub in, I guess, the late 50s.
It was April 1956 when he was performing on stage at Alabama. And some of the members of the White Citizens Council thought he shouldn't be singing those kinds of songs in that kind of a venue in front of white people. And at their prearranged moment, they mobbed the stage, tried to drag him off. The cops intervened and stopped them. He was then flown back up to Chicago and canceled the rest of his tour in the South. It was very sad. He just wanted to perform before audiences. He didn't want to necessarily change laws, but by virtue of who he was and the audience that he attracted, he did change America in many ways.
Now, in fact, he has an interesting change to, well, I'm going to say singing, because he was a jazz pianist initially.
He's still known as the third best jazz pianist of all time, behind Art Tatum and Oscar Williams. They thought he sold out when he went to singing, but he had to make a living. He was practically starving when he was doing jazz, but he was true to his profession. He always thought he would get back to it, but he never did. He left school at the age of 16 years old and went off on his own. Became a great jazz pianist, got stuck in the Los Angeles area with the show. I forget the, at any rate, it was a Broadway show that was brought to Los Angeles, and then he started playing with a trio down there and moved himself forward and got discovered.
And in fact, the heights he got to was to be the first African-American to have his own television series.
1957, Our Family watched. It was first a 15-minute series, then it turned to a 30-minute series. But ultimately, they couldn't find a national sponsor. All the stars appeared on his show for scale because they wanted it to succeed.
Mm-hmm. And to me, there is a kind of mellowness and softness when he brings the song across, which
he
is...
He had a wonderful voice.
Yeah, which is really rich and...
Very rich. And the odd thing was, it was the cigarette smoking that gave him his timbre. He would chain smoke 6 to 7 cigarettes before recording session, but what he didn't realize, it was killing him. And his last concert was at the Circle Star in 1965. He died at the age of 45 years old. Very, very sad.
And that was in the mid-60s.
In the mid-60s. He'd just done Cat Ballou, and he had a cough, a lingering cough, got it checked on. And then he wanted to live because he wanted to live long enough to tell people, do not smoke. All through the wonderful book by Mark Howard Epstein on him, they talk about the memos that were going back between the doctors and the cigarette companies saying that this is really bad for your health, but it really didn't come out until much later, until after he died, actually.
Now, I know we talked at the beginning about Mona Lisa, but the story behind the song is quite interesting.
Oh, it's a wonderful story. Alan Ladd started a movie that was supposed to be called The OSS, and then it was going to be called After Midnight, and then it was finally called Captain Carey USA. And it is about American fighting with the Italian partisans, and they were going to be warmed by this song that the Germans were coming. And first it was called Prima Donna, Prima Donna, Prima Donna. Then it was called After Midnight, After Midnight, After Midnight. And then finally, the wife of the lyricist said, you know, this is about the portrait, Mona Lisa. Let's call it Mona Lisa. And it was the B-side to
a song entitled The Greatest Inventor of Them All, which was a gospel song about God. And they thought it was just a throwaway. All the Italian singers at the time turned it down. Sinatra turned it down. Dean Martin turned it down. Also, Vic Damone turned it down. And yeah.
And it actually had a second life because Bob Hoskins appeared in a movie called Mona Lisa, and he chose the song. He liked the song, and that became the title of the movie.
Oh, so, it's a wonderful song. Yeah. And, you know, he lives to this day. And in fact, his family is financially secure once he died because his records continue to sell.
Now, when we come to the Golden Gate Yacht Club, what NorCal numbers are we likely to be hearing?
Well, you know, formerly the Cole Porter Society, they have many books about Cole and Noel. They both died at 73. They both were the most sophisticated writers of the era. Yeah, that would be a good show to do, actually.
So what Nat King Cole ones will we...
Oh, we'll be doing Mona Lisa. We'll be doing Unforgettable. We'll be doing Too Young. We'll be doing Rambling Rose. L-O-V-E. L is for The Way You Look at Me. My kids know that from The Parent Trap. And so we'll get the whole audience involved
It also teaches you about the alphabet.
Well, it's also the alternative name of the Dixie School District, Live Oak Valley Elementary. And that's going to be proposed this evening.
Have they changed the name?
Well, they're committed to changing the name. We'll see. It's only been around for 155 years, but they say, don't go too fast.
Song that my father always played by Nat King Cole was Fascination.
Oh, Fascination was a wonderful song.
And it's a kind of story song where you can see it's telling you about a relationship, how it goes, how quickly it finishes, and how it all began. So that's a song which I grew up with. And in fact, my father, who did play the piano, really knew him originally as a jazz pianist when he was listening.
Well, one of the songs we're going to do in duet with Amanda King is flying in from Las Vegas is Unforgettable, because he had that revival when he did it posthumously. They took the recording and they interspersed Natalie Cole with it. So it was just wonderful. And a whole new generation became aware of who Nat was. When I was studying music, it was interesting, in the 1960s, early 60s, my voice coach said, he's the only singer that really knows how to produce, sing the words L-O-V-E. He doesn't say love, he sings love.
Love, yes.
That's mellifluous.
Yeah, the extended O gives you the feeling that love's going to last.
Don't be that cynical, Peter.
Okay, we try. So again, just to repeat, on Sunday, starting at 4 at the Golden Gate Yacht Club.
At the Golden Gate Yacht Club.
And I think it's a great setting because on a sunny day, you will catch the sun coming down behind the Golden Gate Bridge. The whole of the bay is just rippling along slowly, and then you've got the smooth sounds of Nat King Cole presented by Noah Griffin.
For which I have the official ballad of the Golden Gate Bridge, as you know.
Okay, you have the song, yes, you have the song dedicated. Okay, good. Okay, Noah, thank you for coming
in
today.
Thank you so very much, Peter.
What you are, unforgettable. Though near or far, like a song of love that clings to me, how the thought of you does things to me never before. Has someone been more unforgettable in every way?
For more information, don't forget the Cole Porter website. That's coleportersociety.org. And Noah's appearing at the Golden Gate Yacht Club on Sunday at 4. Now, as they say, for something totally different, we've gone from San Francisco to the Himalayas. Can you make it in one breath? And that, in fact, is the title of your book. Welcome, Sylvia Varage. And give us the title of your book.
Certainly. The book is called Two Breaths, One Step.
Two Breaths, One Step. And Sylvia will be at Barnes & Noble on March the 10th on Sunday afternoon tea with Sylvia. But tell us first a little bit about the title of the book. How do we come up with this title?
Well, it's very simple, actually. When you're at a high altitude, let's say 16,000, 18,000 feet, you simply cannot take one step with your breath. You run out of breath. So before you complete your step, you find you have to take another breath. So that's why it's called One Breath, Two Steps. You might just find walking around town you could take 4, maybe even 5 steps with one breath, but you slow down drastically at higher elevations.
Now, I think I was going through the book, and I thought there's one passage where you're actually caught in what sounds like a blizzard. Maybe we could hear that just as an example of what happened to you in the Himalayas.
Sure. This is at about 14,000 feet, and I'm starting up the trail. As the trail climbed farther up the valley, the weather continued to deteriorate. I pushed on through the blizzard, the snow falling heavily around me, affording little visibility. The landscape quickly became a field of black and white, offering no clear distinctions or landmarks, the trail gone from view. Soon, I noticed I could not see our guide, Dende, or anyone else. The world tightly closed around me, revealing only a few feet of visibility directly in front. I called out Dende's name, but no one answered. I couldn't see anyone or anything through the blinding snowstorm.
So you're caught in a blizzard. You're at 14,000 feet. You're actually heading up to the base camp on Mount Everest. What happened to you next?
Well, I made it.
Okay.
Eventually, my guide noticed that I was not with him. And he started hiking back towards me, and over an hour later, he found me. I had tried to shelter myself behind a very large boulder, but it was very scary, very dangerous. I didn't have any of my equipment with me, my tent, my sleeping bag. I just had a little bit of food and some jackets. All my equipment was up with the porter.
And there were 3 of you in your group on this particular expedition, is that correct?
That's right. There were 3 of us, but I always say I was really alone. The other 3 were always miles ahead of me. They lived at much higher altitudes in the States than I did, and I just simply couldn't keep up. So I was always trailing behind.
And tell me, you had a guide, but you also had a Sherpa carrying the heavy mountaineering gear. Is that right?
Yes, that's correct. I mean, that's really just how it's done there. It's very important in supporting the economy. The Sherpas really depend on that. And it was so minimal. I mean, when I did this trip in the early 80s, we're talking about $1 a day for a Sherpa. A guide was maybe $3 a day.
And today they're at the $20 mark, and there's actually a union, isn't there?
Well, actually, I just was at a book reading last week, and somebody about to go was telling me that the fee today for porters is $25. I don't know if there's a union per se, but there's definitely more regulations in terms of how much they can actually carry, and it's good for their safety.
So the book came out last year. It's currently available in bookstores. Is this a book based on memory or based on journal writing?
Well, actually, it's based on both, along with some research. I did keep a very detailed journey during my trip, which was about 3 months, and I use that a lot for the book, with in addition to more current research.
Now, just to finish with, I know you live in Marin County, and you're a hiker. Do you have any hiking trails that you recommend?
Well, my 2 favorites are always anything on Mount Tam and anything in Point Reyes, whether you're going to go to one of the beaches there or one of the mountain trails. They're both anything either of those places would be terrific.
And Sylvia, you're going to be at Barnes & Noble on Sunday, March the 10th at 5 o'clock. It's going to be an afternoon tea occasion, so people will have a chance to get some advice from you before they set out on a trail or start heading up Mount Everest. 2 pieces of quick advice.
Definitely train for it, both emotionally and physically. The more, the better. And then just take your time. Pick a trek that you feel you can comfortably finish, but still allows you time to appreciate the wonder and the beauty of the landscape surrounding you.
Okay, Sylvia, thank you for coming in today.
And thank you, Peter, for that segment, as always. A link to Sylvia's website, as well as all of our guests, are at klw.org. Search for Open Air. I'm David Latulip. Thanks for listening. Archived shows are at klw.org. Thanks to Neil Swinkles for producing the show. If you've got a segment selection, by all means, let me know. David@klw.org. Thanks for listening. Mm-hmm.